Thanks very much, everyone, for joining us, and thanks very much for your patience. Today, we're going to be taking a different tack on some of the stuff that has been brought up in the conference thus far. And what we're hoping to look at is in a digital world where we are now starting to have new kinds of identities, or identities that are multiplicitous in a way that we may not have been able to readily express before. How do we continually and ongoing define who we are? And how do we define who gets heard and who does not? It's wonderful for us to have the opportunity to be here and to discuss. I'm going to turn down some of my... Excuse me. It's wonderful for us to have the opportunity to discuss some of these issues at Harvard Law School. But at the same time, different people from different backgrounds are faced with what we call a digital divide that's got really interesting implications. On the one hand, technology has got the opportunity to enable people to leapfrog certain aspects of development. On the other hand, it also means that certain people are increasingly far behind. And as we find ways to reframe the concept of identity and migrate much of our identities online to literally live distinct lives through the ether, what happens to those people who don't have the bandwidth? And so we've brought together a panel of people who work in the arts and sciences and who have an interest in technology and culture to give a little bit of perspective on that issue. Before I go even further, I want to mention that you guys will notice there's this weird thing up here that we're asking you to hopefully log in on. It seems like a couple of you have found us. And we've done this to give you an example of what technology can do. We did a conference for a project called the SMT, which is something that I run. And SMT is a project that basically uses the tools of popular culture, music, television, film, the internet, to empower youth in Africa and the African diaspora. And we had a conference entitled Youth in the New Pan-African Renaissance, Rebuilding Africa for the 21st Century, that was held in the Science Center here at Harvard in April. As part of that, we partnered with a technology company called Midnet in Canada, and we were able to network people from different parts of the world for specific conversations. So we did one on African hip-hop where we had artists in Nairobi, an artist in Accra, speaking with a group of us here in Cambridge. Then we did another session for students at the University of Ghana at Legon, who were able to ask questions of the former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and also a former Clinton advisor, the kind of people who, even if they come to town, you as a college kid in Ghana will never get to see them. It was very, very powerful, and we decided that we wanted to find new ways in which we could leverage the technology. Today we're using it to connect with Marvin Hall, who is joining us from... Well, Marvin, can you hear us?
He's asking if you can hear him.
We can't hear you. We'll fix your audio in just a quick second. There are a couple of latency issues because Marvin is in Kingston, Jamaica. But hopefully we'll work them out and he'll be able to offer a lot to this conversation. So I want to just begin by touching base a little bit about my panelists, all of whom are going to have an opportunity to speak a little further about themselves. Unfortunately, Derek Barris couldn't make it to us today. Hopefully, he'll be able to join us for future events. But I want to start first with the lady far to my left, Ms. Yoko Okwau. And how many of you were at the show last night? Okay, so for most of you, I don't have to tell you who she is, right? Yoko is a phenomenally talented artist. She is widely recognized as one of the best slam poets in Boston, period, and arguably one of the best in the country since she's annually competing in the National Poetry Slam competition. For those of you who may have never seen her before, she's been featured in the major network television. She's been on Deaf Poetry Jam. She is so humble. She will never mention any of that, but she is serious business. And one of the reasons we wanted to bring Yoko onto this panel is to provide a little bit of perspective on artistry and how artistry helps to define our humanity. And I'm not going to put words in her mouth. She'll speak for herself momentarily. Then immediately to my left is Jer. And Jared, I'm very thankful, was brought to us via John Raymer, who sent me his bio, and I was just like, whoa. So he's going to have to explain to you more what he does, because some of it I can't fully even comprehend. But I did comprehend this. He's a serious musician and a well-trained one. He's a composer and a performer representing the West Coast. He flew in on a red eye just today to join us, and he has started a project called Imaginify. And Jared, I'm going to ask you to put Imaginify into words in a few moments, because I don't think I can do it full justice. But when we talk about the intersection of the arts and sciences, I think he's an excellent exemplar. And then joining us in Jamaica is Marvin Hall. And Marvin is, he works with the SMT. I met him through a young man named Wayne Marshall, who is also affiliated with, there are a bunch of us who hang out at Berkman. It's just the coolest place. So you come in, you say, oh, what's up, Clippinger? What's going on? What kind of revolution is going on? I remember emailing Urs like 3 years ago, like, dude, I heard you do cool stuff. I want to talk to you. And Wayne and I went to college together, and we happened to reconnect at Berkman. And I remember talking to him about a project I wanted to do in Jamaica, and he said, you've got to meet this guy. And so I met Marvin Hall, and I wound up a month later spending a week in Jamaica, running around the country on national television and radio, talking about, let's change the world, fight the power, let's use music and technology to do it. He started a project called Halls of Learning, and if you receive his business cards, they will say Jamaica's chief educational revolutionary. Marvin is a math teacher by training, and he is going to be at a program in Stanford in the fall, which he can tell you a little bit more about. And he's done some very dynamic work in bringing technology to youth who typically wouldn't have access to it. So I just wanted to start, again, from where we made the introductions, give everyone a moment to tell us about yourself, about your work, and your thoughts on some of these issues. And then we're going to make it a little bit more interactive with you, Ioka.
Okay. So my name is Ioka Ibie Okwawo. And I'm a poet and a healthcare professional. Where I see culture and access to the internet and access to technology intermingling at this level that I'm in is access to people that may be interested in what I have to say, spiritually, culturally, and just in terms of expressing myself and finding connections with individuals that are open to learning more about other cultures and other diasporas. So that the internet and technology has just been very incredible asset, you know, in terms of getting my message out and finding new outlets and finding individuals that are willing to hear what people like myself, you know, people that have sort of like dual responsibilities in culture and healthcare, finding connections with individuals that are interested in what I'm doing. So just as an introduction, that's where I'm coming from.
Wonderful. Jer?
Hi, my name is Jer. I consider myself an artist, first and foremost, and a composer. Producing and bridging music and art and film, science, and a variety of different subjects has been a lifelong passion of mine. A lot of the different convergent projects that I've brought together have been bridging genres and styles and concepts together from various sort of backgrounds, from glitch hop and regular sort of rock and roll music and classical music, as well as bringing in what I would consider to be a neo-organic aesthetic, sort of a new way of looking at ideas through open source technology and through community architecture, integral theories, remixing, and what Larry Lessig at Stanford calls free culture. I've been putting together a few sort of larger scale experiential gatherings that sort of bring together a transdisciplinary approach, bringing together not only academics, but community leaders and artists and musicians as well.
Wonderful. I'm in the midst of typing things to Marvin to try to translate. Unfortunately, I cannot type nearly fast enough. So, Marvin, we're going to ask you to introduce yourself. And I know that you can't hear everyone on the panel, and that is my bad. I do not have the proper mic setup that we had thought we could do, and so I will translate for you. Cool? In the meantime, just tell the people who you are and what you do.
Hey, everyone. I am by training in Jamaica, but I've also started an organization called House of Learning. Highest quality of learning experiences for children of Jamaica.
Wonderful. Go ahead.
What we are focused on, bring the next generation of digital creators in Jamaica. That means digital artists, digital music creators, animators, digital music producers, computer programmers, all that kind of stuff. And our fundamental belief is that every child has a right to a high quality learning experience regardless of their background. Come from an affluent part of town, or you come from an underserved part of town, their access these types of experiences. So obviously our push is to try and level the playing field for the children who would not normally have access as far as coming from an underserved community and not having access to the tools nor the experiences. So we, as a part of our push, we offer our courses to kids from both affluent backgrounds, but also try to award scholarships to the kids who not otherwise have. Let me stop here.
Thank you, Marvin. Okay. So I wanted to take it back a little bit, and I wanted to go to you, Chair. First, could you explain to us a little bit more about the work that you do, how you got started in it, and what made you decide to fuse the work of people in different fields in particular?
Wow. Well, I should say that when I was attending the University of Oregon and studying music composition there, I realized after reading a book by Hermann Hesse called The Glass Bead Game that music was simply more than what people considered just sound, waves, etc. It was actually philosophy. And the philosophy of integrating together so many different points of perspective and mediums, which came to an epiphany, recently, or in the 18th century, I guess, with opera, where sort of music and theater and art and design all kind of fusing together. And what I had felt after seeing that and doing some work with various fellows and various professors and learning and studying art and music and film, I realized that there was not only a synergy between each of these mediums, but there was also a synergy between the people themselves. So it just so happened that I, you know, a number of folks who I'd been talking to invited me into a working group at the University of Oregon for complexity and nonlinear dynamics. And that sort of broke open a very large egg for me. I got introduced to physicists and psychologists and civic planners and a variety of different folks that I wouldn't have really expected to meet. And in combining together with all the artists that were my friends and musicians that were my friends, I mean, like, just, you know, just straight up just people that I was already in constant contact with, I realized that there was no real synergistic place to bring all these different dialogues together. So in creating Imaginify, which basically just started out as like a number of web links on a HTML site, I ended up implementing an open source content management system and started blogging and bringing in RSS feeds and bringing in the artists' artworks and galleries and basically a sort of a piecemeal together early form of what I would consider a wiki now. Mm-hmm. And those ideas just sort of started meshing together in a way that was really appealing to my friends. The main crux of really bringing those ideas together also happened to work around the idea that we wanted to be a visual language, a symbolic language, and to create a pattern language that folks that were my friends and people that I was associated with in all of these different disciplines and these different arts and in these different communities could actually just sort of see a visual icon of a very larger scale, what I would call a meta discipline, a discipline of disciplines. So I think that's a good way to start.
Wonderful. Wonderful. As you have started bridging this gap, are there any challenges you found in the way in which people, I guess in the language that people use to communicate their ideas? So I think the way in which artists oftentimes look at the world can be very divergent from the way in which academics do. And in particular, you know, from my own experience in academia, I know that academics typically learn a rarefied language that oftentimes a lot of other people cannot relate to. And I know that in music, there's oftentimes a sort of a penchant for the more organic or a sensibility of authenticity that may or may not match with the way in which academics express their ideas. So are there any challenges that you found in trying to create what is effectively a cross-cultural dialogue?
I would say, of course, the languages that are spoken in academia are pretty siloed in general. And like you said, in art and music as well. But something about art as sort of the focal point, meaning a place where people can not only see each other in a larger community, but how do I put this exactly? There's the problems that we experienced weren't so much in getting people there or having them talk to each other. What we found was actually that what you were describing is that the language itself needed to be sort of a translator. Mm-hmm. Between my friends who were artists and my friends who were musicians and my friends who were academic, or these my friends who ended up becoming friends of mine who were academics, and part of creating a new meaning language and a new visual language was basically employing art as a tool to do that cross-cultural communication.
Mm-hmm. So that the artistry itself was the way in which you bridged the gap.
Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. I'm just going to type that to Marvin because I think that's worth hearing.
Okay, well, that is an excellent segue to mm-hmm. a question for you, Yoka, in that, first of all, I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more perspective on why you became the artist that you are, because you're not just a poet, and you also are very concerned with social issues as well. And then if you could talk about, first of all, why that came to be for you, and then also how you think that has impacted your ability to communicate certain ideas to people who may be coming from a different perspective.
Right, okay. Well, I went to college at Northeastern University. I graduated with a degree in pharmacy. And so I sort of started my experience as an artist in sort of like a dry medium. You know, pharmacy isn't really anything creative. It's very direct. You know, there's nothing. There's no guesswork really in that field. And I sort of found myself in a creative space where writing took me to a level of expression that was necessary in allowing me to stay sane in this society. You know, and it's really interesting with what you're saying with how you sort of use your experience in academia and your interest in art and you know and as a musician to sort of link you know these two groups together, allowing you know allowing you to communicate and allowing you to present opportunities for each of you to be expressive in your own way. That's exactly what I think helped me develop as a poet. You know, as you know, there's a lot of different area. There's a lot of places you can go to perform your work and share your work. There's a lot of places for me to go to perform my work and share my work, but the technology part of it sort of takes it to a whole nother level where you know people from all around the world are able to sort of to see that there are people that exist that are into you know that can be into you know healthcare and into you know spiritual well-being and sort of colliding these two into like a whole new you know revolution. And so being a part of this, I sort of feel like the child of multiple worlds, you know what I mean? And I feel like I've been able to take advantage of technology to sort of help express sort of get my word out there.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Marvin has posed a question that I think is interesting. Marvin, can you just frame that question for us all together? You're saying, how do we get the disconnected masses to view the network as an opportunity? And I'm asking, what network do you mean specifically? Do you mean the internet? Okay, that was very beautiful, except the crux of the question was completely lost to us. So, you said, how do we, and I'm going to ask what specifically. And we're going to put that out to the audience as well. Well, let me translate for him what I think he's getting at. So basically, you heard what Marvin was saying about folks who have never been connected, who don't have a MySpace page, who've never had a chance to be online. And I think what the question he's trying to ask is, how do we even articulate for them the value of joining these types of social networks? How do you articulate to somebody the importance of a digital identity and a secure and trusted one when they have not a concept yet of what a digital identity is? And is it in our interest to be drawing them into the fold? And I would love to start to get people involved in that. And if you could give us your name before you answer.
My name is Clea, and I think Hernando de Soto's work is really relevant to this because he's a book about the mystery of capital, and it talks about why Western systems work and how we always mess up because we can't really see what they are because we're in them. And there's this representational system that's developed where it's not so much that I own my house and all the neighbors know I own my house. It's that I have a piece of paper that represents that I own my house, that I can do things with this representational system that I can't just do if only my neighbors know I own my house in an informal system. And I think there's an opportunity to give people representational systems for themselves, and then they can go do things like start selling and in ways that are more abstract than just locally in which you can operate. And so there's that potential if it's done right.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that representational systems can somehow be of value to those who are not connected into the net?
No, like or the value of getting connected is so that you're in a representational system, which is your digital identity, is a representational system that you can use for yourself in a particular context, namely online, that gives you power in the world.
Got you.
So like you sharing Marvin with us, there's possibilities for Marvin, for us, because he's here being represented. Which is saying, your neighbors know you own the house, don't you? It's that piece of paper that gives you rights to do more in the broader space.
Got you.
If you're opening the door, new possibilities can surface for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Large opportunity for a voice to be heard. It's true. Right.
John.
Derek, I just want to, I don't know if you saw or heard Walter Becker talk about the new laptop or the internet laptop.
I didn't hear him speak about it, but I've heard of the project.
And I mean, there's a real effort to, and it creates mesh networks right out of the box. And there are a lot of community building principles and a lot of thinking about that. I'd be interested in the reaction of people to that. So their goal is to reach, what's it, a billion kids. And they're going to be launching in a number, I don't know how many countries. But it's really thoughtful, I think, a lot of them, which are how they're trying to do that. I mean, that's one avenue. And then there's the other avenue is just like the wireless networks of the mobile phones and what that they're going to evolve into. It's amazing what can be done there. And there are new kind of healthcare platforms that are being implemented, currency systems that are being held on mobile phone networks. And I think it's important to sort of meld these things and get them at a price point where they're just $60 for a mobile phone or $40 for a mobile phone, or subsidized. But I'm sort of interested in how to merge these things and create new creative mediums that make them accessible and overcome these certain cultural barriers that people pick it up, respond to, and they're robust.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the interesting things that comes, one of the interesting arguments I've heard, particularly with reference to $100 laptops, and that I think comes back to the issue of, you know, what do we want people to do? How do we want to address the digital divide? Are we looking to bring people up to speed? Are we trying to get people to leapfrog certain aspects of development? And that is that, you know, so to play devil's advocate, let's say you give a number of kids access to these laptops, which are now, they have more connectivity, but they have less functionality than a typical computer. So somebody is not necessarily going to learn to write code, per se, on that laptop. And that if that person does want to become a coder, then they're going to do what happens right now, which is they leave and they come out to the West to gain a more robust education. And typically they stay.
Well, let me answer that. There are things like Second Life that you can create virtual communities and actually economies inside of. And actually you can create work that you can sell on a global community or on a local community. You can create digital institutions. And Second Life was maybe some bandwidth issues. But those things are going to go away. So I think that if one's thoughtful about it, it doesn't necessarily entail a migration out. I mean, and you're seeing a more advanced economy. And so it's a way of trying to working with people who are doing this who are well-intentioned and learning from it to shape the technology in a way that we play.
I really disagree. I think that the one laptop per child thing is who asked those kids and those parents and those cultures if they wanted those laptops? And I think there's a real issue about cultural disconnect. Young men are the drivers of sort of going to the modern world and abandoning traditional cultures. And we're at a time when, look at Helen and Norbert Hodge's work on Ladakh. I mean, I think it's important to figure out how you talk to cultures and you invite them and you create opportunities and you don't just like cloth lock tabs down without some of the colors.
I don't know if you're doing that. That's not a fair conversation.
Well,
but I think there's a legitimate concern that you don't want to pose it. And that'd be one of your concerns with how it, to create something that's culturally acceptable. Mm-hmm. But you guys listen about that.
I think she was waiting, and then please.
I believe there was a project that was done by Pamela Minyard from, and some of the early people from Even, where they went to a place in Guatemala and gave the people there access to computers and to the internet so that they could create a way to sell their goods directly to people on the internet and accrue the profit that had been going to middlemen for the crafts and things that they were making there. I know that in some respects that might change their culture, but at the same time, it enabled them to spread their culture and to benefit from that spread. And I think that sort of project makes all kinds of sense for people who are disadvantaged in some way. That mm-hmm. is a way for computers to really make a difference, for connection, such as Marvin is talking about, to really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. John?
I was going to say, in this last session, a woman is here from Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And she came, she says, our identity is now pirates mm-hmm. because of the copyright laws, mm-hmm. how our culture is being commodified. And the commoditization of their culture, the implications of then the people not having the money to get access to their own culture, because their culture is being exported to those who can afford to pay for it.
That is very, very interesting. So she was saying that we're becoming pirates.
We're known in the global world as pirates, I think.
Yeah.
Because we can't afford to pay.
To pay for what?
Yeah. And sharing with each other there is not stealing. They say it's collaboration there.
Right.
What we consider stealing is their collaboration.
I want to actually touch on that. I think that's a very interesting point, and particularly, I know I didn't give you guys a lot of background on myself because hopefully you got to read the bio, but my interest is in music from a performative aspect, also from the way in which it influences the way in which we see ourselves, how cultural dynamics are impacted by arts, and further, the mechanisms that allow us to hear certain things and not to hear other things. And from that perspective in music, one of the reason I came to know the Berkman Center is because of these debates on downloading, P2P, file sharing, what's going on with RIAA, what is the future of digital music. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is the disconnect between the ways in which people, consumers, see themselves naturally consuming music and the way in which the law and industry we've set up says what they determine to be legitimate or not. One of the a gentleman I was speaking to actually, who founded the company that built this the back end of this technology, was working in Russia for years in dealing with internet connectivity prior to the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, they were way ahead of their time. And at one point, I think most of the data flowing out of the USSR was coming through them. And he, after the fall, everything was confiscated. They lost their entire business. And he was telling me that even though they were doing successfully, they were doing well, they were innovators, that all you could buy in the stores was, I think, pickled pork and a certain kind of potato. And that everything you could, get some rice or some bread or whatever it is, some milk to live on, you had to go through the black market. That they had created a system where you had to be a criminal just to survive. Well, let's take it back to the Brazilian example. I think that if you look at the way in which the pricing of culture is structured in the West, oftentimes that's not going to work for developing countries. So what happens to somebody who wants to consume but who can't afford to do so on the level of a society that's got enough capital to allow for leisure? Right? Everybody needs art. Art in a state of nature is free. But now we've said this art is available to you if you have the resources to pay what we consider a fair price. And what winds up happening in places like Brazil is you have a quote-unquote black market that is existing in full display. I mean, you can walk down the street and buy any number of bootleg CDs, and they look great. Mm-hmm.
not as good as the ones in China, but good enough. Right? And it is, and everybody knows that it exists as a parallel to the mainstream. And I think that an interesting thing to look at then is as we start bringing not only technology to different parts of the world, but also the ways of thinking about ownership and access to that technology, what happens when that meets people's cultural systems that don't necessarily mesh? I would like to translate that actually to a question that Marvin just posed that I thought was very interesting. And it's a few bars up, but basically he's saying, well, you think about projects that are looking to invest in Africa. Let's say we're bringing in the laptops and there's a certain amount of capital that has to go in just to make it possible. And we're looking at governments to provide it. Well, these same governments have not applied the resources that have been coming down for the last 30, 40 years to helping those people, so why would they do it now? And I put that out.
You know, I'd actually like to address these ideas with you guys, and really appreciate you, Derek, for bringing these ideas to light for everyone here. I'm currently working with a nonprofit, which I'll leave nameless right now, that works with indigenous people in the rainforest. And part of the work that they're doing is to connect what they call the North and the South. The people of the North, meaning us in the Western world, and people of the South, meaning folks in the rainforest. And the disconnect that you're describing is very readily apparent. And what they're not seeing is they're not seeing the cultural gift, as you would describe it, this cultural gift that in essence what I was describing analogically as being the South wants to bring to the North, which is the idea of biodiversity, the idea of environmental sustainability. But these ideas meaning that they're living in their environment. They're not living in a built environment. They're actually living in their environment, and they don't need computers. They don't want computers, and that's a very simple subject for them. But what they do recognize, and what the North in this analogy is bringing to a very small group of them, is the ability to hold back the march of progress. Mm-hmm. So computers and digital technologies are being used to sort of educate and in essence elevate a small proportion of these indigenous people, and usually it's someone that they found in the Western world that's come to actually do the work for them and live down there with them. Mm-hmm. But basically it's to hold steadfast and say, this is the natural world, and the intrusion of digital technology is not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is a collaboration so that people can understand why we want to protect this so badly, and at the same time disseminate to the world all of the information that the West is trying to sort of extract from that world. So I think that there's not only I don't want to sound like, you know, that digital technology is bad in any way. I think that digital technology and human technology, like open space technologies that will be used tomorrow, are good examples of what I call the real to real, the human to human. And I think that teaching folks in the West or in the North in that regard, human to human technologies, and at the same time teach people in the South or, you know, indigenous people about what the digital world and the abstracted reality that we've created, which is a fantastic tool. And I forget his name. That's Marvin said. You know, is a great catalyst for people to be able to really share and promote themselves and for people to see them, but it's not a panacea.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, so I'm going to push the envelope a little further in this question. That's why I love getting to be moderator.
I feel like it. And I would say, you know, Marvin just made the point, you know, you could start with a small group of people and make it work for them and watch it spread virally. But I would actually like to put a small challenge to that. So is that what we really want? Right? Is what we really want to see us plant the seeds of technology, of education, of access in the world and watch it spread like wildfire? And I would pose, for example, the current situation that we find ourselves in vis-a-vis India and China specifically, whereby we now have people, I mean, India and China are largely poor countries to this day. I mean, there are so many people in those countries that don't have access to the basic necessities. At the same time, their growth rate, and particularly that of China, is unprecedented. And you're having more and more people who do have access, who are educated and who are bright, who can do the same work we can do, sometimes better, faster, and cheaper. And now, all of a sudden, the discussion of development in the world and of access to technology and education has been an antagonistic one. Because how are these people going to take our jobs? And I'm curious. Let's say that you're able to give a laptop to every kid in every village in, you know, wherever, country X. Derekonia. And all those cute little Derekonians went and learned everything there was about that technology and then started extrapolating and building wonderful things that could potentially be competitive in a global sphere. And you're thinking to yourself, man, I'm going to have to hire a developer and this guy lives in Manhattan and he's charging me $100,000 to do this piddling project. I could code it myself, but I don't have the time. And this kid in Derekonia, he'll be like, give me $150. I'll make it happen. I work all year. And with that, he goes and buys a fat house. Like, he's actually feeling good about it. What then happens to our discussion and our perspective on the rights of access of all the world's peoples? Is it good for us to advocate that people have access to technology when we feel like it's something that we can offer, we feel free to give to them? Will we still believe in the same value of that good when those people appear to potentially be competitors? Thoughts?
Well, what thought? When the technology's good, it's transparent, like your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
If it's working, it's invisible. So we want to give them access to opportunity. And when I hear you speak, I say, bring it, as our favorite, this great designer said, bring it on. Let them have these opportunities. Let us all, I mean, in the end, we're competing with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can give this, it's access to opportunity.
Absolutely.
That's so powerful now. The technology, if it's good, it just won't be invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And then the potentiality of being able to say to Marvin something today that couldn't have been said before, and offer something to Marvin that opens doors there, that's what's keeping me optimistic about the future.
Mm-hmm.
So this little vote is, let's do it.
And I'm agreeing with you on that. It's about opening up options. And from a, like a creative standpoint, we've seen the music industry go from being completely run and controlled by like five major labels. We've seen that disseminate to a whole bunch of different independent artists being able to come out, you know, on CD Baby, different mediums online to promote themselves, to create, you know, CDs and packages and booking situations that were never open 10 years ago. You know, so from my standpoint, everyone has an option. We do have options, and to be able to create options for situations like what Derek was talking about, you know, hypothetical situations of allowing those to be opened up to other individuals who would have not have been, you know, had it accessible, I think it's huge, you know what I mean? And just as you were talking about, you know, certain indigenous people, you know, they want to stay true to their culture and they don't want, you know, the influx of all this technology. They want to keep it simple. That's their option too, and I think that it's important for us to respect that. And maybe it would be up to us to sort of understand where they're coming from and then blog about it. You know what I mean? You know, put in your perspective of what you, you know, what you feel about, you know, their culture and translations into that.
You know, I'd like to just add something to that, because I really respect the way you just described that. Not only do I agree with you, but there's so many catalysts that I've seen personally in my life that have come from people having access to the internet just alone. So I really do believe in some ways that access to the internet is a fundamental, almost human right. And not only that, but open access archives being available to folks, you know, archive.org being one, and a number of other ones that are emerging now, being a sort of a focal point for people not only to digest information, but also to be able to access that information and then be able to sort of bring it back to their communities of folks. And someone said something really, really profound to me. A fellow at Stanford said he went home for the winter break, and he spoke to his dad, and his dad made a funny comment, and he said, "Isn't it funny how you can read a book from the 17th century, but you can't read an email from 10 years ago?"
Wow. I'd like to take a comment there, then I'm going to go to Marvin, and then we're going to come over to you. And please do give us your name as well.
I'm Andy Oram from O'Reilly, O'Reilly Media. And I think we can never predict where a great innovation will come from. Like about 10 years ago, I don't remember hearing much about Scandinavia, maybe 15 years ago, as I say, as a place for computer technology. I didn't hear much about Scandinavia. But here, most of our cell phone technology comes from there. The Linux operating system originated there. The MySQL database originated there. So who knows whether the next great thing may come. Maybe someone from Cuba or Brazil or Sub-Saharan Africa will be doing some research into AIDS, and they'll come up with a general solution to immunodeficiency diseases that will completely change our healthcare system. So you have to give people the opportunity, because everybody may benefit in the end.
I think that is an excellent place to bring you in, Marvin. And so, gentlemen, can you tell me your name one more time, please? Your name.
Oh, Andy Oram.
Andy Oram, who is in our audience. He's made a very interesting point that you never know when the next gen innovation is going to, where the next innovation is going to come from. He cited the example of Scandinavia, which has given us Linux, MySQL, and a number of other innovations. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, who was thinking about Scandinavia as like a technology hub of innovation? And so he's saying, well, who knows, maybe the next innovation could come from Cuba or Guatemala or Ghana. And I wanted to post to you, first of all, there are a couple points you raised which I'd love for you to be able to share, but first, more specifically, what are the prospects, what do you feel like, you know, is the advantage of bringing these Jamaican kids to the table? If these are kids who people in the Jamaican society itself have forgotten about, have written off, are not interested in, why are you, why should we be? What do you think is the opportunity potentially for people to contribute once they are connected?
Once they're connected and recognize the sort of digital identity as an asset, one, as an asset in a way to generate an income, two, as an asset to develop some kind of upward mobility, which means you expose kids to this technology, their thinking is enhanced depending on the activity that they do, but they also broaden their perspectives, their options, and can add to the whole labor pool in the country, in addition to the labor pool of the connected network.
Okay.
Young adults, which we also try to target.
Go on.
It's just like that story of, you know, the SETI project, where you're trying to use these idle cycles of the compute. Think of every disconnected person as an idle cycle, then how can we access the knowledge and the energy that they can bring to the network?
Yes, that I think that is an excellent point, and I think we all pretty much heard you loud and clear. I like that last idea of, you know, of each person, right, potentially having a value to this network. But I would like to take that back to how does culture fit in with technology? How does our way of looking at the world come into play when we're talking about technological development? Because, again, to push back a little bit, I would argue that right now, as our societies are often structured, we don't necessarily feel that every person is a valid contributor. You know, we have certain things that demarcate the value of your contribution. If I walk up here with, you know, if I walk down the street in Cambridge and my pants are sagging a little too low, and my cap is a little further over my eyes, you know, my intimidating grill causes some people to cross the street. And then when I show up with my resume and all my Harvard tags, I'm given the legitimacy to not only be allowed to speak, but to be perceived as worth listening to. But I was the same dude. Mm. Right? So that right there is not even a technological issue. It's a cultural one. And I question, in a society where we have not yet learned to truly value the contribution of every potential participant, will we value the contribution of those excluded from the digital era to such a degree that we are going to go and invest money to get these people involved on the off chance that they might be innovators? Look at all the smart people we got in here already. Oh, we can do it. I can do it, you can do it. Who needs anybody else? The track A people, oh, they're fine, they're smart. But come on, this is track B. Right? And so I'm just wondering, what would it take on a more, on a broader level, a broader ideological level, for us to truly believe enough in the value of each contributor to the network that we make it a priority to give them the opportunity to develop their own digital identity, so if they so should. How do we maybe start to value their basic human identity first? Or do we perceive that as a necessity? I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak.
Yes, that's great, because our...
And please introduce yourself as well.
Mawaki Chando from Togo. I wanted to disagree slightly with John.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also related to what you just said. Opportunity is good, but technology is neither good nor bad. It's opportunity which is good. Now, if you go and give 100 or 100,000 laptops to the kids in the village, what are you trying to achieve? If you want to teach them how to type the keypad faster, then what after that? Do you think by giving them a laptop, you will sustain their connection to the internet in a village where they have problem having the electricity? Where even if there is a telecenter or something, you go there, you may end up by paying more expensive for the telephone connection for the dial-up than the laptop. So those kind of projects designed from outside, and they think that it would be good for the kid in X country, just as it would be good for the kid in their own country for them to have the laptop. It just it won't work. So I think the thing is, the approach would be maybe to create the opportunity or to create the needs, but not in the sense that you give them the end product and then they'll need to have the connection, to have to have that to make it work. But bring people at a level that needs become structural. It's their need, because they are in a state that they need that to achieve something. So what I wanted to add also, that internet is the result also of the cultural shifts, the peer-to-peer mentality, so cultural or whatever. That means to get to an innovation, the society get to some level so that that innovation become necessary. So you need to take that into account, all those parameters in order to make it work.
Mm. Yeah. Go ahead.
I wanted to say something that brings us back to identity, and it's going to be a while to put this together, and I think I can say it fairly quickly now. We see Marvin on video, and that's an old technology that goes back over 100 years, and video has been a wonderful way to make things, to see reality more closely. But from the very beginning, people also knew that video could be used to distort reality and impose the filmmaker's view on things. And there are a lot of people who don't want to get involved in media because they say someone's going to use it to distort me and misrepresent me. And I'm afraid that digital media could do that too. So if we talk about giving someone a digital identity, we have to make sure that they can, I think other people have said this, that they have control over the way they can represent themselves. So people can see them as they want to be seen, not just as other people portray them.
Mm-hmm.
There's some people like Dave Hughes, who many years ago started to go to little communities and do a sort of one laptop per child thing. But he did it very sensitively, at least as far as I understand it, making sure that people had their language on the system, making sure they had visual systems if they didn't want to use text or typing. I think that will make people more interested in getting online and having an identity.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts?
My name is Tova Raymer. And the question I think I have is what makes it different that we want to bring technology to indigenous removed cultures? What's different between that and the Crusades? And we want to bring democracy because it's so good, right? You know? And to me, I mean, I don't want to preserve people in poverty necessarily, and I don't think a lot of those people really think they're living in poverty. And ultimately, when I look at those cultures, they are a little lot happier than we are with all of our technology. So that's where I get kind of, I don't know what really is the best thing, I guess. We have to really look and see. I mean, yes, I want to make these opportunities and their voices to be heard. At the same time, are we not creating more endangered species? You know, are we all going to be wired and then, you know, then the aliens will come? Then we'll be the next. I don't know. But that's the question I have about it. What makes this difference? That?
And do you want to make a comment?
I think two things are getting conflated. Having a digital identity and being able to like communicate via email and perhaps even have a voicemail box is very different than having your own computer. They're not the same thing. And that there's the telecenter stuff, there's things like last mile wireless things where like they have a little scooter that's on that does the physical mail drop around to villages that now has a Wi-Fi thing and like they're sending emails and stuff. Culturally appropriate ways to bring technology in ways that aren't like that may actually work and serve people that are different than giving everybody a computer. So they shouldn't be conflated.
Can I just add to that?
Yeah,
that I think that, I'm Ellie Stefanski from Global Giving, and I think that actually many of these solutions, not all of the solutions, but sort of when we think about technology outside of sort of like wires and computers and sort of things coming together, but basically a tool that enables you to do something that you couldn't otherwise have done. A lot of these technologies are actually coming from these communities that we're talking about. And we look at microcredit, which is a great tool for lifting people out of poverty. It didn't come from the United States, but has actually been imported to the United States and having great impact here. And I think that I think that it would be great to kind of broaden the conversation to not think about it as a transfer, but more sort of like, somebody started off, I think it was Aaron, you, Derek, started off the conversation with talking about who do we listen to, and global identity as a mechanism for helping us identify who we listen to. So I think that it's, you know, these great ideas, these great technologies, and these great solutions are everywhere. How do we sort of cross the sort of cultural issues and sort of communication issues that builds by creating some type of global identity to actually make that happen? And I actually think that, you know, pop culture, pop music, pop, a lot of sort of like mediums actually have the ability to do that. And I'm gonna get off my rant in a second. But there's a great, there's a Carlin Nee, who's the founder of the Stanford Social Innovation Review, is sort of leaving her job and creating this basically this reporting tool for enabling beneficiaries of nonprofits to report back on how well this nonprofit served them in ways that are culturally appropriate to them, either through, you know, pictures or video or music or whatever it is that they express themselves with. And I think that tools like that, and I think about that in terms of, you know, how do I get sort of the organizations that I work with in other countries to sort of report back on the money that they're spending, and sort of, you know, tools like, you know, cultural mediums that are appropriate or that they relate to is such a powerful tool. So just wanted to sort of circle that, bring that back as a mechanism for a tool for, like, global identity and helping us figure out who we listen to in this world rather than sort of thinking about it always as a transfer, either of wealth or knowledge or tools.
Awesome. Jay?
I think I wanted to actually go off of your point and also yourself, Tova, because the title of the talk was Human Hybrids. Mm-hmm. And I have a, you know, it's a very loaded term, to say the least. And I wanted to just give an analogy really quickly of the use of the word hybrid. The only real example I have right now, and I'm not going to give any commercials for cars or anything like that, so I won't say that either. But I'm recently, you know, planning on buying a biodiesel vehicle, and I went and looked and spoke to some people about buying a hybrid biodiesel vehicle, or a hybrid diesel vehicle. And what I found out was that I could run, you know, 100% biodiesel, 80% biodiesel in the diesel, just the plain diesel vehicle. But when they went in and they started, you know, people actually started driving the cars and, like, you know, filling the gas tank of the hybrids with the biodiesel, the car would break down. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that it wasn't the fuel; it was actually the hybriding system that was actually the issue. You can only run 2% biodiesel in a hybrid biodiesel vehicle, according to what they said was their sort of acceptable amount. And 2% for hybridity is, you know, you get my drift.
That, go ahead, John.
I thought it might be relevant to these. So the French historian Fernand Braudel said that all development is driven by changes in the limits of the possible and the structures of everyday life. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like guided me through all these technology conversations. But I want to make a personal point. So Tova and I have been together 25 years ago. We're hybrids. I think in some ways what works well in this relationship is what we need in this global relationship. Mm-hmm. So there's this issue about how do you maintain autonomy while you invent OB. So how can we have a global identity that doesn't overshadow each of us and our own unique, particular personal contributions that we make? Mm-hmm. So how can we feel connected to Marvin in a way that what makes Jamaica what it is isn't less, but becomes more? Mm-hmm. And that requires, I know, a sensitivity to each other, a respect for each other, an orientation towards each other that isn't easy. I mean, you know, when so many people come up to us like they can't believe we're together for 25 years. And we better learn whatever that is at the personal level, because at the global level it's the same dance we've got to figure out how to do it.
Hey, would you mind if I jumped on John's point there? You know, John, the idea of these unconferences that are emerging and really teaching people human skills again, human-to-human skills, that's really what I hear you saying from your heart of hearts, because, you know, you and Tova, are, you know, it's the love you share, and the fact that, you know, when I touch this screen, I'm not touching the person. You know, when I can have some haptic device, and I can da-da-da-da-da, but the point is that what we're missing to some degree is literally that human-to-human energetic component. And that, to me, if digital technology can teach people about how to be more human...
You know, I'm going to jump in really quickly, because I wanted to touch base on a couple of things, but I'm also playing scribe. So I think first I just wanted to come back to how popular culture can potentially be a way of bridging some of these gaps and a means of discourse. And I think that it's related to what you just shared, John, in that, you know, it is a way potentially of providing that respect and understanding of who you are while still coming to an idea of who we are. That's kind of what we were trying to get at with the musical mashup last night. You know, the key thing, the most important thing, as far as I'm concerned, in doing a musical event, is to make sure that the people who come have fun. If it's about you as the artist, just doing what you love, then you could have done it at home. Why are you going to draw people out of their environment to come and see you do you, right? At the same time, just as we want to make sure that the people who come have a good time, they're entertained, they enjoy themselves, they feel somehow spiritually moved or uplifted, we're not going to do anything to make sure that you have a good time, right? So in the work that we create and in the artists that we created, they're not going to talk about killing people. You heard the peace bit. That was not by accident. They're not going to come out there with a bunch of half-naked women who are probably not getting paid enough to be half naked, no matter what they tell you. They send me a big enough check, I'll do my little thing too. But that's beside the point. We're going to have certain barriers that, even as we are considerate of you and what you want, are also going to be considerate of we and who we are. And this is, and I keep coming back to some of the challenges of this stuff, because I want to put it out there that when we're talking about these issues, there is no simple solution. Now, we need to go to deeper levels if we really want to see this digital era expand to encompass us all. Part of the reason why I talk about the idea of human hybrids is because this is precisely the stuff that I've been researching that pushed me so far that I dropped out of my PhD program at Harvard. Because the more and more I learned about how technology and access to it is developing hybrid identities in young people around the world, the more I realized something had to be done, lest those hybrid identities wind up being more destructive than empowering to those kids. I specifically wanted Gokbi System to perform last night, and for those who weren't there, it was a Senegalese hip-hop band, because I wanted to show the fusion of Africa and the Americas together in this group. That's also part of what we try to represent in Solfege. I was having the most fascinating conversation with their manager before they got started, Pop. And he was telling me, he was like, yo, you know, a lot of kids in Senegal don't see Gokbi System as hip-hop. Why? Because they're playing a traditional instrument. And sometimes they sing and they've got the dancer and everything. You don't see Jay-Z with that. Jay-Z don't have an accounting. Jay-Z doesn't have that dance. The percussion, that's not hip-hop. And it's a gross irony, because the way hip-hop evolved, where it came from, was from people taking the tools at their disposal and making instruments of those. When you had people cutting the funding for you to learn how to play the trumpet or the violin or whatever in your school, well, fine, we're going to learn to play these turntables. So it comes from a place where, yes, we are going to take whatever we've got and we're going to create with it. But now, the way in which it is represented leaves people to believe this is what it is, this is what it isn't. How is that applicable? Well, you have people who have been by virtue of technology, given greater access to the Western world. And the flow of this information has been so unilateral that they have not had an opportunity to express their own identity. And the effect is not only that we don't know much about who the hell they are, but oftentimes they are starting to lose that sense and that value of who they are. Now, it's a hard thing when you say, I'm going to come from the outside and teach you to be a better Brazilian. But if we really believe, right? Eu falo um pouco de português, but, you know, mais ou menos. But not enough to tell you how to do your due. But if we are that serious about a technological revolution and about the value of giving digital identity to all of these people in the hopes that they will be contributors to the global good, how do we make sure that we're hearing them too? When we're going to give the laptop, what are we getting back from you? How do we develop that as something that is a part and parcel of this project towards development? That is a world and an interface that is really and truly an exchange. Because what I see happening now is we'll give a few laptops to some kids. We will also get some brilliant youth that someone like Marvin is going to go out there and recruit and train. And those people will become the elite. Like me, born in a house with no running water. And here I am. What's happening to everybody else who was born in that house with me? I would like to throw that out there.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up again on what John said and what you just said. I think that's the good effort. This time I totally agree with you. The thing is, when it's done by an international organization or states, and you request them to be at that level of attention, it becomes negotiation. And negotiation doesn't mean there are interests involved, and there's no dialogue, actually. That's the pattern of negotiation, you know, in international arena. I was at Tunis at the World Summit on Information Society. I think that was where Kofi Annan launched that project of $100 for a laptop for every kid. And it's not the first project of this kind. So I'm just wondering, when I heard this kind of thing, I just wonder who are these people fooling? I mean, if Africa or whatever country it is can develop with this kind of initiative, we would have known long ago. So I believe where the technology is great, is especially internet, is the fact, the possibility to allow community building. What our friend in Jamaica is doing is great, because it might help the kids to localize the technology and to build community around and thanks to the technology. And that is the place where they can start innovating by themselves based on that innovation, which is internet. Mm-hmm. But if you design projects in the international organization or wherever, and you say we're going to distribute a for kids because you want to give them opportunity, you end up by making them dependent or something, but mm-hmm. you don't give them opportunity. Mm-hmm. So it's good, I think, to we as individuals, as citizens, we can take initiative and share things and build communities. I believe that's the best way to go.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Throughout all of this, I want an opportunity to be able to connect with people. I don't always have the money to be able to go back home to Nigeria and interact with my fellow countrymen, but you know, through cell phone use and this internet thing, I am creating opportunities to be able to connect with my people again, you know, and that's where I see the good in, you know, in what can come out of what we're trying to create here, and the open-mindedness that we're trying to achieve here is to be able to make those connections, you know, the kind of connections that we may not really be able to afford, you know, in other circumstances, you know. And I know that I have access to that, and I feel privileged to have access to that. To see my, you know, my parents in Nigeria, you know, take back a computer home, and just sort of trying to develop those connections out there as well. I think that's so important, and that's what is driving me at this point. That's what drove me to come here today, you know, to sort of, you know, express, you know, the need for that connection that I feel, and that I think a lot of people in this room feel as well.
I want to, we're running into the last few minutes of the program. So before we get close to wrapping up, I wanted to take a moment and, Marvin, address to you. I would like for you to talk briefly about the Lego robotics project, what you did and what the students accomplished, and how you believe the development of this digital community, this technological community that you are working on, is ultimately going to empower these young people.
Started a project in one of our inner city communities during, and basically it was a follow-up to utilize the investment in students who had come to our summer program from a kind of, but essentially the plan was to coach a group of kids to participate in a robotics tournament in California. And how we had to do it was, you know, rent a room in their community. Now, yes, the option was there to do it outside of the community and, you know, transport them to another point. But it was very important for us and for the project to show that something positive could happen inside of their community. Inside of a community where, you know, there's very little hope and there's a lot of violence going on. And these kids were very committed, showed up every weekend, you know, in spite of, you know, how it might have endangered their lives. And we were equal to the commitment that they showed. At the end of the day, we were outsiders coming into the community, but at the end of the day, we developed some kind of trust and we created a hope in the community. Something positive could happen, even in spite of all the negative violence and killings that were going on. And so, essentially, we took these kids to a tournament in San Jose, California, where they actually even won a judge's award for their overall performance in the tournament. And, you know, it was a great accomplishment for the kids. You know, I mean, they even got to tour Google, which most of them don't fully understand the importance of Google in the whole network. But at the end of the day, I kept wondering, you know, what next? What do we do next? How can we build something that's sustainable, that, you know, doesn't depend on me necessarily coming down there every weekend? How can we, you know, bring a resource to the community that will, you know, empower them and be a sign of the beginnings of empowerment for the community, you know, through the technology. And so, in our next project, part of it would be to build a robotics learning center in the community that will be a drawing card for the younger children as well. Because if you don't intervene with the 8 to 14 year olds that were looking in on what we were doing, then they're going to be the ones next year that will be firing the guns in the gangs. Because, I mean, I don't know if a lot of people know, but most of our gang members are between the ages of 12 and 19. And they're the ones firing the guns. And it is them that the hope lies in for the community. And so we have to find a way to intervene, use technology to draw them in, and help them see the further opportunities that exist. We're not suggesting that they're all going to enter robotics and design robots, but through this technology, they will learn more about the computer, think differently, learn to solve problems differently, and begin to understand their value in the global network and, you know, in connecting to the internet and being a part of that community. So that's our goal. We want them to realize their value in themselves, in their community, in the bigger picture of the connected network.
Beautifully said. Thank you. And I think that that is a wonderful way to bring us to a closing. And part of the reason why I was so adamant about trying to connect Marvin to us, whatever it took, is because I went down there with him on a number of occasions. And to give a little bit of perspective on some of the communities that he's talking about, we were at Liberty Hall, which Marvin will recall. We went there a few times. This is the offices of Marcus Garvey when he was alive, and they had fallen into great disrepair, and they'd been renovated by this lady, and she built like a museum and a youth arts and cultural center and a technology center where the kids could come and learn how to use computers and things like that. And we decided, well, we're going to shoot a video there to big up what they're doing and let people see it, etc., as opposed to just at the typical resort. So we're going into Liberty Hall one day, and we call up to speak to the executive director, and she says, a person who has phone is like, oh, the ED is gone, and we're all leaving for the day. I was like, well, why are you leaving? It's not closed for business. Like, oh, well, there's been gunfire, and so it's not safe. We're like, so everyone's got, like, well, the security man will still be there. We're like, okay, well, we have to check the location. Gunfire is something that happened in Kingston, so we come in anyway. We get there. We check things out. Everything looks cool. We duck our heads down. We get back in the car. We drive off. Within 30 minutes, we're just listening on the radio, just to the news. Within 30 minutes, there comes out a report that that entire part of town has been shut down with tanks and helicopters. The military has moved in because the fighting, they were so scared about the potential for escalation because one of the people that got shot was a drug don. Right? Now, we talk about violence in the communities in the U.S., and I know it's bad, right? But when was the last time that the National Guard had to go into Roxbury? And this is a natural occurrence. That's what's going down over there. I look at the cats I work with in Ghana, and they're like, yo, it's so funny to us. We hear American MCs talk about their hardcore. Like, we don't have drive-bys out here. We have coup d'etats. Bring your whole gang, see how they do against the army. And what he is saying is that they are effectively using technology not to take these kids out of their community. Take the technology directly into it and help these kids to find ways to see a world that's bigger than where they are. And I think that that is the power of what we're trying to do. When you're talking about a human hybrid, we're saying that, yeah, I could be living in the worst situation you could possibly imagine, and I can have hope because now I'm connected to something greater than me. Maybe I'm learning something from you. In the best system, you're also learning something from me as well. And I feel like that motivation, the example of what's being done with Halls of Learning and with other projects day to day around the world, and I mean, these are things that this kid is financed out of his pocket. You know, there is no Ford Foundation grants behind what they've done. And I don't know if you mentioned, but they gave 100 scholarships to kids who can't afford to pay. The kind of work that people are doing on the ground, I think those are the things we want to support. Those are the things we want to learn from. Because if we can find a way of allowing technology not to be our way of, you know, feeling better about we're helping the world, but in actually giving people the tools to help themselves, then I think this goes way beyond the creation of a digital identity. We're getting to the creation of a human and of a global identity that is actually respecting of all of its participants. And I would love to thank you for participating in this conversation. We're dismissed. I think it's lunchtime.
Just as a postscript, I wanted to offer all of you guys Imaginify.org, the website that I helped start, as a resource for positive news and good things going on in the world that people can definitely, I find a little niche there. So I just wanted to offer that to you guys.
Bet.
Much love.
Marvin said one love.
Yeah. One love.
One love.